Right, welcome I've to lost Secrets
blind
of Desert
Blind. I've lost a blind man. Blind man's buff. Lose a blind man. So it's a lose a blind man. You start off with a blind man, and whoever can lose him the quickest, basically. And then he has to go around and bump into people. I think that would be a better idea for a radio show. Blind man's buff on the radio.
I'm going to format that idea and use it this afternoon. We'll get more audience. Yeah, so the premise of the show is that I'm going to ask our panel of four, which is now two, because I'll introduce them officially in a minute. Steve's already sort of introduced himself. And then... I'm going to ask them questions and they can answer whatever they feel like it. And then you guys have got to vote on who's been the most honest. So they might be lying, but as long as they're presenting it to you as the truth, that's fine, as far as the performance
goes. But you might be lying saying that.
I could be lying saying
that. So that might not be the rules of the game at all. See? We don't know. That's what you've got to work out. Sorry, I'll shut up now.
Audience members. Very, very welcome. Let's start off with, let's introduce Steve Day, who is a deaf comic. And let me, you introduce yourself. You're doing a show at the Fringe.
I'm doing the show at Cafe Royal about art. You see, it's very, it's very nice, very intellectual, and stuff. But with a few knob jokes bunged in. You see, art with knob jokes. So, you know, the ideal combination. So that's me. I'm about 70% deaf. I don't know that. I've done half my material already, and I'm in up half a seat. I was running. I forgot I was on this, and I got a text. So I've come straight in. I've lost the blind man on the way. And we found another one when I got here. Which is like, you lose a blind man, you find another one. You know, that's what it is.
So can we introduce Kevin Knight, who's partially sighted?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm substituting for Chris, and I am not as blind as him. And like Steve said, I'm actually probably about 60% blind, but I do glamorise it up to 75. And that's it. I'm a blind comedian, or a partially sighted comedian. And this year at the festival, I'm not performing seriously. I am running this venue. It's a phenomenal venue. Come back and see some of the other shows.
Well, we will have a bigger audience. I think this show lends itself to late night drinking audiences. I think we'll put it on later next year.
I've got a much nicer shirt than this, by the way, over there, but I didn't put it on yet. Will they know on the radio?
They might. It smells so strong, Steve.
I've been Arthur's Seat. It's good to run up.
It's very good, Arthur's Seat. I have not even humbled
that. Get out of the way.
My name's Sabrina George, by the way, and I'm chairing this motley crew. And I've got this show that I'm supposed to be looking after with Kevin. And in the evening, I've got a show called Crime, Comedy and Me, which is about my life in crime and my family. We're all middle-class criminals, white-collar crimes. My brothers are very unsuccessful. They went to prison. I haven't, so I'm the most successful in the family. I'm the white sheep in the family in the criminal world. So that's happening this evening. But for now, I'm basically going to start asking these guys questions one by one, and knowing both of them, they'll probably deviate from the subject dramatically, but that's what's going to be interesting. We're going to go on to a different tangent. So Steve, my dear friend.
I'm ready.
I love Steve. I've known him for years. It's fabulous. Why did you get into comedy?
Black magic. And no, it was a mistake. I was I don't know, I always wanted to, and I didn't think I could because I was hard of hearing. I used to say that about everything. I didn't do anything because I thought, oh, you can't hear. Do you know what I mean? You can't go running. A bus might hit you. I used to do that, and so I looked through Spotlight. Is Spotlight the thing? Not the anti-Nazi thing. What's that? Spotlight or Floodlight? The one that's not the anti-Nazi league thing. And there was a thing for comedy workshop. I looked through the anti-Nazi league thing, and it's the anti-Nazi league comedy workshop. And I thought, I'll go to that, because I'm not doing anything. And I was between lives, you know. And I rolled up, and I thought, this is really good. And from that moment, I was a comedian.
So what was the pivotal point that got you to pick up the phone and book that first gig?
Nothing, because I can't really use the phone.
How did you book the first gig?
That miraculous time. I suddenly discovered I could use the phone after all these years. My God, it's a miracle. And I've joined the Anti-Nazi League, and now I can pick up the phone to go see Floodlight. And I wandered in. I went to it was the City Lit FE College, and I just wandered in, and that was it, really.
You did a course?
Yeah, you see, I got so desperate. I did, though, in my life. I got so desperate and wasn't doing what I wanted to do. And that was that itself was a bit of an epiphany. Do you like that?
You had an epiphany.
It's quite good for me to be using words like epiphany in the morning.
And what about you, Kevin?
Well, unlike Steve, I actually wanted to join the Anti-Nazi League. So I was trying to look for their magazine, but by mistake I got Floodlight because I couldn't see what I was looking at. And I saw there was a comedy course in it, so I didn't go on it. I only saw there was a comedy course in it with a magnifying glass, because I was checking through looking for various things to do, and I thought I'd do that, but I didn't go on it. And then that was ages and ages ago, and then my eyesight got consistently worse because I'm diabetic, and in the end I was actually writing for people, and I thought, well, this is a bit stupid really, because disability is sexy and I might as well write my own stuff and become a comedian. So about 3 years ago, that's what I did, which isn't quite as, and it's kind of like you gradually develop from being just somebody who thinks, oh, I'll do comedy because I've got a disability and I can use that disability, to actually doing comedy and the disability comes in a little bit while you're doing it, which is what's gradually happened. Next question, please.
It's really hard to see what you're saying under that moustache.
Really?
I can just see the moustache going up and down. It's like trying to lip read a grass
that
skirt.
That is why the alternative profession I considered was being a ventriloquist. But I decided that guy with the bear, whatever his awful name is.
I saw Strasman. I didn't know you wanted to speak to him.
He had the market cornered in dodgy moustache ventriloquist. So
I like the ventriloquist he did, Peter Brough, who did it on the radio.
Yeah.
Isn't that the easiest job in the world, to do ventriloquism on the radio?
And then they invented television.
Years it was on the radio.
They invented television and he died because they could see that he wasn't a ventriloquist. Brilliant.
Right, by a quick show of hands, who's been the most honest? No, we've got to move on to the next question, Steve. Chairpastor. No. Kevin?
Boo!
Fantastic!
Boo.
Fantastic. Kevin won. You won that round, in case you couldn't see. The hands were up in your favour.
Right,
the next question is, how much do you think luck, and in fact I'll ask Kevin first, how much do you think luck has played a part in your career as a performer?
Well, I think luck does play a big part in a career as a performer. It's just unfortunate I haven't had much yet. Because it does depend a lot on who sees you when. Are you doing a good gig? Is it to a lot of people? Is it to two people in a small room in Edinburgh? Or is it to 50 people or 100 people? And there happens to be an agent at the back. So I think luck plays an enormous part. And so far, I mean, I've had some luck because, I am earning a living at it now, but I need more luck. So if you know anyone that can help me be lucky, please tell them.
Is that it? Is that the end?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think, because we were talking about this the other day with some other performers, talking about luck, and I think there is a degree of luck, but I think it's an awful lot of performers put luck onto someone else's responsibility. I was unlucky with my agent. I was unlucky with the audience that night. Someone last night had a packed out gig that went the best it's ever gone, and they had no reviewers in. And they said that was really unlucky. And I thought, to have a sell out show where you had a really good time and call it unlucky because a reviewer wasn't in is a weird way of looking at things. And I think if you have two people and a reviewer's in, and you have a storming gig with two people, the reviewer, I think, will have, you know, it's not about luck, it's about do you do a good show and enjoy yourself doing it, I think. But I think today, lunchtime, is probably going to go down in history as one of my luckiest and most fabulous gigs. Tonight, I think today's a lucky day, isn't it?
I think we've got
a lucky audience.
Brilliant audience.
So, Steve, what part does luck play in your career, do you think?
Like what you were saying is that they say, don't they, in golf, no, the harder you work, the luckier you get. I think that's true. But I haven't had much luck because I came up by car this year. See, I flew up last time. I was here 2002 and they brought my luck, but I drove myself up and I forgot to bring my luck up with me, you see. Didn't have any room in my car. I had to leave a space for my Perrier Award, you know, for the way back home. And that's where my luck went. But last time, everything went lucky, you know, in that way. And this year, I had a great show the other day, and there was no press when they were supposed to come. And then last night, fewer audience, and the press turned up. But it didn't matter. I just enjoyed doing it anyway. And they can sell that. And I tell you why I was unlucky as well. The show I did in 2002 was called Deaf in the Afternoon, right? It was in the afternoon, Hemingway, you know, see how clever that was. But then I did a tour of it. It's still going. I did it this year. And they changed the time. It was in the evening. It became Death in the Evening. And it kind of... Hemingway shot himself before he wrote Death in the Evening. Which was really annoying, selfish of him. Could he have not thought, you know? I mean, I'm sorry you didn't catch any fish that day, you know? Just don't think about it. And so it's made it a bit hard to follow. But, as well, that Death in the Afternoon, Death in the Evening, caused a big problem with deaf people. You know, profoundly deaf people.
Why?
Well, they say that they're deaf with a big D, right? That's the way they say it. Like, deaf with a big D, or deaf with a small D, see? And I'm small D. And after the end of one of these shows,
you're partially deaf? You're small D?
Well, I'm severely hard of hearing, so I'm quite
That's
deaf.
Small D?
The small D, yeah.
That's how it's defined.
Anything other than profoundly deaf.
Right.
Deaf from birth. People who use sign language is their main, is their culture, right? And they're really like, they are the elite of the deaf world, you know? And they really protect their territory. But they don't want hard of hearing people getting in on it. You know, they don't like that. And is it the same for blind?
Well, it is, yeah, because, for instance, I'm partially sighted and I'm just about entitled to a guide dog, but I never get first choice because the totally blind always get first choice.
They get Lassie, and you
yeah,
end up with,
I get yeah. some little
Lassie's gone
terrier.
By the time
yeah.
he gets there.
Yeah.
And, but this, I did Deaf in the Afternoon, Deaf in the Evening earlier this year, and this profoundly deaf bloke come up to me and he's really angry, really angry. And he was going, "You're not Big D! You're not Big D! You're small D! Right in my face, you're small D! You're not Big D!" I said, "No, I'm not Big D." Well, no, I say about it in my act. He said, "Yeah, but on your posters, you got Big D. You're not Big D." Fucking hell, mate, it's the start of the sentence, isn't it? You can't please everybody, can you? I've either got the punctuation police after me or the deaf police. I can't... Anyway, I called him a wanker with a big W and he went off.
that's true.
My answer. So luck does play a part. Yeah,
yeah, but
I was just
going to say that is absolutely true because people, I can do my routine. People think you're a character comedian. They don't necessarily think you really can't see. And the irony is, like, I can see a little bit and I can see, like, the front row. I can just about see you, right? You're blurry, but I can see you. But if I actually talk to anybody in those rows, oh, he can see, look, he's putting it on. And it's like, it's a nightmare, because what do you do? You can't, if you spend half your act saying, "No, I really can't see, I'm Big B, right? They don't believe you. It's just, you know, it's like a nightmare.
You're Kevin Knight, aren't you? And I'm Steve
Day. I know, wouldn't it be
Knight
brilliant,
and day,
eh?
You know, isn't that fantastic? Night and day, you know. Sorry.
Yeah, for him it's nightmare.
That's
how that
would be on Radio Quiet or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Radio.
Well, but you did have a bit of a lucky break, which one of the members of the audience recognised you from just before the festival started.
Oh, after Winton.
That was,
yeah, that's
that
me.
Must have affected
yeah,
you a little
that.
Bit.
Yeah.
Go on,
yeah.
Tell us.
Well, they asked me to audition for that, and I think they were quite keen to get a few, you know, they wanted to spaz it up a bit. They do. BBC really want to spaz it up a bit. But they asked me to audition, and... I'm all right. I normally sit at home going, "Oh, it's obvious, woman," you know. And they say, "Oh, it's harder under the lights and all that." But not really. If you're a performer, it's not really. You know, you're used to being looking
sweating
an idiot under
the
lights.
Yeah.
And it was good fun.
I didn't see it.
Oh, well, you missed out there.
You won £47,000.
Yeah, but I could have won 100 grand.
Yeah, but only if you killed the woman that was against you.
Sorry?
Only if you killed the woman that was against you.
No, she was all right. No, it wasn't her fault. It was like, I didn't know the music. They brought up a music question.
Oh, yeah, I see.
Oh, no, they
yeah,
didn't.
For 100 grand.
No.
I know everything about music up until about 1982, and then I've got no idea about anything.
That is so unfair.
I've been wrecking up here in the supermarket, and people are like, "Oh, that was so awful." But I think, you know, hopefully it's tugged the nation's heartstrings. If the checkout woman at Morrison had seen me, you know, felt...
It's all been worthwhile.
But
so
I forgot it was money. I was just having a laugh, really. And Dale Winton's very nice. He's much better than I thought.
He's a nice bloke.
And far less orange than you might imagine from looking at him on the TV. He was very nice.
And what was it like when they handed you the cheque for £47,000?
It's not real. I know. I wanted to say that. This is not real. It's a dummy.
How do you get paid then?
They send it to you a week later, which is, you know.
And have you spent it?
Yeah.
Good. I'm not going to ask what on.
I spent it on women, drugs and booze, and the rest of it I just wasted. That's an old...
That's
George
Best
Stan Bowles, I think. Robin, George Best.
That's George Best, yeah. Can you tell us Actually, I should do this. Talk about the worst ever gig. Because, well, again, worst... Because I'm a stand-up as well, in case I didn't introduce myself very well, did I? I'm a stand-up as well. And the worst gig I ever did was in a little club in London called Pear Shaped.
Let me have the vote. Let me have the vote on the last one.
No, because... No, yeah, no, we haven't. We haven't had the vote. You're absolutely right, Steve. He's on the spot. Can we have the vote on who's been the most honest? Kevin, by the show of hands? Or Steve Day? Steve Day, we're at...
So you're saying I can't see, are you?
That you're fully sighted, I think, is what they're saying.
Okay, fair enough.
You're small bee. You're small bee.
Small bee.
I've never heard that. That's great. I'm going to use that. Small bee. That's good.
So the next I was just going to say the next question I'm going to ask is what has been your worst gig that you've ever done? And there's lots of variations on worst gigs. It was probably the worst gig was in a little club called Pear Shaped in London, where they deliberately try and make things as pear shaped as possible, which is terrifying for new acts. But older acts love it because it sort of throws things into a complete spin. And the presenters, the compo is a musical act who just comes on and he plays music, which is very funny and brilliant. But the audience is not... We don't know who the audience is. And the first act went on, and they were quite good, and they died completely. There was total silence. And then the second act on, quite good, died, total silence. There wasn't even a whisper in the room. So I went on the third act, and I did... It's a bit of a comedy cliche, but I said, does anyone here speak English? And this voice at the back said, no, we're all Bulgarian, and I'm the translator. And that was why nobody laughed. They were all just sitting staring at us. And that, to me, was probably the worst thing. I realised I had no physical comedy. I had nothing to... No music, nothing to actually lead into these people who couldn't speak a word of English.
You had no Bulgarian material.
I had no Bulgarian material. I've worked up about a 20-minute set now, just in case. It's in my back pocket, a bit of Bulgarian.
Based on umbrellas.
Red wine, Bulgarian Merlot or something.
But you've got to speak it in the Bulgarian.
Oh yeah.
I've gone
Sorry.
To
the
studio to do
Bulgar,
yeah, exactly. Bulgar. So what's your worst ever gig, Steve Day?
My worst ever gig. It's a lot. It's a big competition. You know, but on a cruise ship, I got asked to do a cruise. I've been doing this for 7 years, this job. Not this panel game, but this job. And I got asked to do a cruise after only a year and a half. So it must have been a mistake. But I thought, this is it, glamour. You know, lovely ladies, sunbathing. And it was nothing like that because everybody was so old. You wouldn't believe it. Not just slightly middle-aged, these are the oldest people I'd ever seen alive. And honestly, people who look like they're made of nothing but paper and a heartbeat. You know, that sort of old. On the second day of the cruise, we docked, it was in Naples, Fossils Around the Mediterranean, it was called. We docked in Naples, and a hearse pulled up at the dockside. And I really wasn't sure whether they were picking somebody up or dropping them off. But it's the thing, isn't it, comedy? You've got to try and find something for them. If you've got Bulgarian material, you know, you've got to go to them. And... So I thought, what can I do? But it was lucky. It was the same week the Queen Mother was 100 years old. And I thought, I'm saved now. I'll talk about the Queen Mother. They'll like that. I'll start with it. Because I read in the paper a story that week, the week before, it said, on the Queen Mother's 100th birthday, they're going to get her to walk to church with the aid of a stick. And I thought, that's cruel, but effective. Come on, you old bitch. 10 more yards. Come on. And I was doing it. And they didn't like it. And the worst thing about that, though, not just the gig, because I was stuck on the boat with them for another 5 days afterward. I mean, they were so agitated.
Were you doing a gig every night? Or just
no,
one?
But just one gig, one big gig, 500 old-age pensioners. And I've offended all of them. You know, like, they got so bad, they knew they couldn't shout anything out. I wouldn't hear them. So they're trying to knit a sign really quick, you know. Taxi for the deaf bloke. And we're stuck on the boat. It's a nightmare, but... That's when I found out one of the really good things about Alzheimer's disease, because by the next day they'd completely forgotten about the whole thing.
And two of them.
Two of them thought I was their grandson. I got a cake and a cardigan. So that's my worst ever gig.
That's your worst ever. What's yours, Kevin?
Well, my worst ever gig is a gig that I actually never did, but I went to do, because I was booked to do this gig in the middle of nowhere in Suffolk. Which sounds bizarre because they said it was a great gig, and it was a 200-seat theatre, but it was in a little village and it was part of the European Arts Festival. So I'm booked to do this gig, and I get off the train at this little village, and I get off on the platform, and the platform I got off on, there was no way off of. So, and there's no one on the platform. So I walk up and down the platform, peering at signs, trying to find out if there's a bridge or a subway or some way, because obviously you go out the other side and there'll be life, hopefully. So in the end, I found this sign, right? And I got my... I use a magnifying glass when I really got to read something. So I got this magnifying glass out, and I'm reading this sign, and it says, this part of the line is not electrified. You can walk across here. Of course, what it doesn't allow for is somebody who can't see spotting a fucking train coming. So I waited there for like half an hour for a guard to turn up, for someone to turn up on the station, because it was unmanned. And then this guy turned up, right? I was then about 25 minutes late for the gig. And he turns up, and so I said to him, look, I can't... Look, how do you expect me to walk across this line, given that there could be a train coming? And I swear to God, he said to me, it's all right, the trains don't go very fast through this station. Which I thought was brilliant. So he got me across the line. By the time I turned up at the gig, it was kind of too late for me to go on. So it was nearly finished, because it was a one-man show. It was slotted into a lot of different performances, and I had 45 minutes. And by the time I got there, my slot was over, and they'd just all been sitting there laughing. So it's kind of... That's the worst gig, is the gig I never did. I did do a gig like Sabrina as well, where the entire audience was Italian, which I thought was going to turn out to be a diabolical gig. And then I realised, just before I went on, that one of the comedians on, who was also on, happened to be Italian. So I did the gig with him translating. So I did my routine, and then he translated to the audience. And that was turned out to be, I'm probably preempting another question now, one of the best gigs I ever did, because they laughed twice. They laughed at my material and him doing it. It was great.
Who was it? Stefano?
Yeah.
Stefano Paolini. He's really good. He's on.
Yeah,
he's not as good as that.
A show called Britannian.
See how clever that is. Britannian. Look. Britannian. See?
And he does lots better of voiceovers for cartoons. British cartoon telly. So a vote on who's been the most honest. Kevin or Steve Day?
That is true. My story is true.
Doesn't matter. It didn't come across as true.
I didn't say it very well. I still have nightmares about it sometimes. I still wake up thinking, oh,
oh, it's terrible when you drop a clanger. Someone on Friday night made a joke about Robin Cook, and it went down. The rest of the night was here. The rest of the night it was a complete no-no. So, Steve,
yeah.
If you could have someone else's material or be someone else, who would you most like to be in your...
I never want to be anyone else. I don't want to follow anyone else. Sorry, is that not a...
No, it's sort of more like, whose material would you really respect? You feel, wow, I'd like to write something as good as that.
I like old-fashioned comedy. I don't really follow, you know, comedy much these days. I can't follow
what
they're saying.
Yeah.
So I'm not really... I'm quite old-fashioned, I think. I like old-fashioned comedians, like Les Dawson. I like Ken Dodd. I like to do that. I like to do four-hour shows. I went to see him. I went to see him twice. And my wife left. She couldn't take it after that. She quite enjoyed it, but just thought 2 hours is enough.
No one believes him, do they? I haven't seen it before. No one believes he's going to do 4 hours.
Yeah, I know. And he comes on and he's so old. I mean, he's 78 or something. He's quite old. And he starts off as an old man, but after about 3 hours, he's young, you know, joking, and it's unbelievable. And it does go on a bit.
And everybody's fallen asleep.
So and sometimes I can't hear the joke and I'm still laughing at it. I don't know why that is. It's a timing or whatever, a stage present.
It's the silliness of it
I've
as well.
Ho-ho, madam. I don't even know what you're doing anymore.
That's who you would be. What about you, Kevin?
I know it's a cliche, but it's not so much who I'd be, but I'd love to be able to do material like Bill Hicks, where you actually made a point, who's a really famous American comedian from way back, who's dead, who actually was able to do comedy and make political points as he was doing a comedy without it becoming boringly political. That's what I'd really love to be able to do. And I think that's what a lot of comedians will be able to do, and very few can. They can make people laugh, but to do the two combined is just great. Or I quite like to be Jewish and be a Jewish comedian, because I think the boring thing is that when you're not I haven't got like I've got the visibility thing, but I don't have a distinctive voice in the sense of being Northern or Jewish or whatever. And when I see again, like Steve, really old style type comedians like Jackie Mason, and they're able to just use their ethnicity to actually bring a different thing to it, I think it's great.
So how many minorities do you want to be in? Jewish?
No, I would like to be. I actually volunteered to have my foot cut off. But no, I actually have been in hospital twice where they've said that I'm going to lose my foot, and I keep saying to them, I'm not that bothered, really. It'll add to the act. And they're
Adam
struggling to keep
that.
It.
Adam Hills has got an artificial foot. You can't take his territory.
Well, yeah, but I'll have a dual combination then.
Yeah, combo. It's
combo, yeah.
We are quite sick comics, the areas we try to pick out just to make ourselves.
I could have a leg.
Special.
If he's got a foot, I'll have a leg.
What disability would you have? You need the disability now in comedy. Honestly, you're nowhere. Unless you've got
it's a rock and roll, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I'd like to have been Richard Pryor. I think he's. Except I'm not black and I'm not is yet a junkie. He's very unwell. I went to see his daughter's show actually last night, which was very good. Rain Pryor. It was more theatre than it was comedy. It was really nice though. I liked it. I thought it was very, very good.
One of our shows, the cameraman went up to her and said, "You're Lionel Richie's daughter, aren't you?" And he kept saying it. "Shut the fuck up. You're Lionel Richie's daughter." I don't know. He thought that. Well, near enough, you know. Carry on.
No, it's just because one of the things that's difficult in comedy is that you have to be believable in what you do and you have to put it across. And I don't know whether you know Richard Pryor, but he was born in a brothel and his mother was a prostitute, his father was a pimp, and he was born in sort of the backwoods of nowhere in Tennessee. And his comedy, when you hear it and you see it, he manages to completely translate it so that everybody can understand where he's from and what he's about. Whereas, I mean, I'm middle class, like you, Steve.
Really?
Yeah, I am.
Am I middle class?
Yes, darling.
No, I don't know.
So you're suggesting that I'm definitely not, are you?
Stevens is middle class, but now you've made me middle class. Thanks. Richard Pryor found a baby in a shoebox, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be my life, it'd be the wrong size.
It was probably his.
Oh, come on. Oh, no, I can't get it on. He's nicking me around the toes. You know. Like novelty slippers or something.
Sorry. I'm
not going to get a word in. I'll
say that to his daughter. So it'd be advertised in the Sunday Times in those things you can get, you know, like the haircut and stuff.
Well, that weird advertising.
Novelty
about,
baby
like,
slippers, that'd be good.
Sports and stuff kind of tucked away.
Yeah.
You mean like baby slippers?
Yeah, you know, baby slippers.
Made of real babies.
Yeah.
He's got five.
What's that?
Five babies.
Yeah, that two pairs of slippers and one extra.
In case you get a three-legged person.
Yeah.
Or I do have my leg
cut
off.
Well, yeah, if you do, I'll let you know. I've got a slipper, Gary. Might be the wrong foot. It's just your luck. Question about luck.
Yeah.
You find a baby slipper on the floor and it turned out to be for the wrong foot. I mean, now,
The foot that's missing.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Then you're in
real
trouble.
But then you could have your foot stuffed and mounted. You know, the one you lose.
And put the slipper on it.
And the slipper could go on there.
Yeah.
Right, girls, who's been
couldn't
the
they,
most...
Couldn't they make the leg that you chopped off, save it, and mount it, you know, and kind of embalm or whatever they do, and then kind of have it as your full leg, you know, like a prosthetic leg, but it would be your real leg, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be,
So
which is all right, as long as the leg they cut off, they haven't cut off because it's been diseased or run over by a train or something.
What, being on the wrong side of the track and having your leg cut off on the way to a gig. Save the bit that you lose or measure
it.
He's always
working, Steve. Can you hear? Always working. This will be next year's material. How I found a baby in a shoebox and turned it into my leg.
I think it's a serious medical point how you can lose a leg that you have amputated to be your prosthetic leg. It was saved material, wasn't it?
And look more natural.
You're a black person, you have to have a white leg, don't you? Or you have to wait for ages because they haven't got many black legs.
Or get a can of spray coat.
I don't mean they're on strike, didn't they?
Yeah.
Whilst these two are witchering on, who would you vote as being the most honest? Kevin Knight or Steve Day? Oh, look at that. There's a draw.
They're divided now.
There's a draw.
Divided up.
Right,
I think
next
question. Why don't they have amputated legs as the prosthetic leg?
Because of preservation problems and it's smelly.
You could spray it.
And Damien Hirst has got most of them.
Sorry?
Damien Hirst.
That's what I was going to say. Send it to him and he could embalm your leg. You could at least visit
And you could have a picture of it on the wall as well. That'd be brilliant.
What do you think? I'm going to. Steve, Steve, let's just change the subject of rotting, smelly legs.
But I think we've discovered we hit on something.
What do you think is stopping you becoming the most successful act on the planet?
Aren't I? Oh. Oh no, you're worse than the Scotsman, you are? Don't know really.
Did the Scotsman ask you that question?
Sorry?
Did the Scotsman ask you that question?
No.
Oh.
No, they just told me I wasn't the most successful act on the planet. They kept reminding me over and over. Kate Chopstick. No, actually, she quite liked me, Kate.
Chopstick.
It was the other one, Fester didn't mark it, but never mind. Lack of talent, time, energy, five kids, wife. I enjoy what I do. I don't see it as a rat race. I just enjoy doing gigs. And
so you don't think there's anything holding you back?
No, not really.
From more success?
I feel quite successful. I'm quite happy. I'm on the radio and I can't listen to myself. That's the best thing about it, really. doing a tour. I've got a show. No one's coming yet, but it doesn't matter. I'm enjoying it. You know, there's a mirror in the back of our venue. There's sort of a bar with a mirror, so I'm enjoying watching myself. You know, I've given myself 5 stars. I want someone from The Guardian to come and give me some stars. I can say I knew it was The Guardian because they had their stars in the wrong order. You know, something like that. It's not happening at the moment, but I could have.
Nothing at all. What about you, Kevin?
Definitely laziness. Definitely. Because I've been reflecting on what you said earlier, and you're right, you do make your own luck, and I don't make my luck. I just amble along. There's all sorts of excuses for that, like the diabetes and stuff, but really and truly, I overcome loads of stuff, so I should do it, really. Plus, the other thing that's holding me back, I think, is too many limbs. One less limb, I think I'd be there. One less limb, I think I'd be.
Oh, yeah, over.
Or deafness, if I could go deaf as well.
No.
Only small D, only small D. Only small D.
The Helen Keller route.
Yeah.
The Helen Keller guide to success.
Yeah.
There's not been a Helen Keller for a long time, has there?
No.
There's going to be one in comedy, I think.
Well, I think we put you two together and we've turned that into that. So you think you're a bit over-limbed?
Over-limbed for success.
Lazy and over-limbed.
Lazy and over-limbed. Unfortunately, obviously, if I did become less limbed, I'd probably become even more lazy, which would counteract the benefit of having less limbs.
Right.
Because I don't move much now, but I'd move a lot less and do a lot less with one limb less.
Shall we vote on who's been the most honest? Steve Day. Whoa, and Kevin Knight. Sorry, Kevin, you're lying through your teeth.
The quality, the speed of
it. Yeah, it was very fast, yeah. They cannot believe I'd like to have a leg chopped off. That's what it is.
Didn't say it, by the way.
Right, what really annoys you most about your profession?
Profession?
Yeah, what annoys you about?
Driving. No, I hate driving. I drive about 1,000 miles a week at the moment. Actually, I quite like it. I can get away from the kids, you know, and have a think. It's the only time I'm a carer, you know, 9 to 5, like daytime. It's the fact that you've got to be. Sometimes you seem like you've got to be trendy. You can be as good as someone else, but you won't get it because you're not the in thing. That's quite annoying. Do you know what I mean? You have to battle against that. I'm never in the gang, you know, of who's trendy.
And why do you think that is?
Because I don't talk to people. I'm miserable.
That's not true.
I've got kids. I've got to go. You know, even last time I'm going to bed about 12:30, which is that unseemly early, isn't it, for anybody? But I'm still waking up at 7:30 in the morning. So I get that. Oh my God, where are they? What are they doing? What's on fire this morning? So, and I'm not in. I don't go to the parties and all that. So I hate that you have to do that stuff. It's not enough what you do on stage.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so what? You know, I enjoy what I do on stage, so.
Yeah, because I find there's an enormous pressure of the sort of legend of what makes a good comic, and sometimes it's like, oh, you've been in the press today, and actually the PR person has brought you into the press, but it can give a buzz to someone, which isn't true.
That's
or someone will say they've had the most phenomenal success. I mean, I will walk out of this gig today and I'll say we sold out, and I bet you people will some people will pick that up and go, oh, she sold out, she must be good. And it's got nothing to do with it. It's absolutely unrelated as to whether...
That's what I was trying to say. I don't really care about all that kind of... I think it's all bullshit, but it's the people who are supposed to be helping me, making me care about something that I'd rather not care about. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
You've got to go here and do your flights. You've got to go and do that. I just want to do a show. I want to write comedy and do comedy. I don't want to go and give out badges on the Royal Mile or something.
But even if you do have a success, if it's not a success in terms of being in the newspaper or...
No.
Being there's a lot, as we know, there's quite a lot of comics who are on television, and we know other comics who are not, who I would certainly suggest are much better.
I think comics on television are marvellous. I do. I love them. Anyone who's been on television deserves it. You're just bitter and twisted.
I am bitter. Like, we all knew Bill Bailey was a fantastic
act.
He's
brilliant, yeah.
And then he did, what was it, Dead Books or whatever it was
Black
called.
Books.
Black Books. And suddenly everybody, and they were going, oh, isn't he good? But he was brilliant before that. And every gig I saw him do was fantastic, but people didn't know.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I thought Bill was fantastic to actually ignore all that, and he just kept going and kept going until
he'd
the right...
He's brilliant phrases, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's fantastic. And we know lots of comics like that. We see other comics who maybe could do
a
bit
that,
more.
Yeah, I think that. I know comics who are brilliant and never got anywhere near being famous. And they'd slog it out, like me, up and down the motorway.
As brilliant as you,
but
really.
But people who are... They are miles better than... They're much better than that. Jimmy Carr, for example, who I know. I mean, it's a nice bloke, and I started about the same time. But there are a lot of comics a lot better, aren't there, than Jimmy Carr?
About 95%, I'd say.
And you're being generous.
That doesn't really annoy me. That's just the way it goes, isn't it?
It is just the way it goes, but it's part of being a comic or being a performer is to try and ignore that and not buy into it. Go, oh, I must do telly at any cost, because then people will perceive
it's
me as
when
being
it comes
successful.
Back to people saying, but you're not as good as that. That's annoying. But no, I'm just not on the telly. It's just the way it happens.
Because I have been to those comedy parties, and honestly, it's a bit like going to a wake. Everyone is so depressed, they all talk, they go into a complete, like, oh God, so-and-so is so awful to me, and so-and-so won't book me, and so-and-so didn't recognise how brilliant I was, and they put me at the wrong slot in the evening, etc., etc. And you just sit there and you just go, God, being a comic can be the most depressing.
Like,
and it's those who don't go to the parties who actually have a better time.
Yeah. If you go to those things, and then everybody's like, talk to you for a little bit, and then they start looking over your shoulder trying to find someone a bit more famous. You know what I mean? You're trying to look at them and they're saying, yeah, that's it, yeah, oh, right, that's, oh, I'm sure they will. You know,
excuse me, are you an agent?
So what do you think the most annoys you, Kevin?
Agent.
Oh, I thought you meant, are you an Asian?
No.
Have you got a rucksack? Oh, is that what you mean? Are you Brazilian? Okay,
that's the way of losing limbs, though. So,
Robin Cook? Yeah.
So what's your what's the thing that most
are we still in the game or are we just talking?
Yes, we are.
Oh, sorry.
All right.
Sorry, I thought we finished that.
Thing that most annoys me is that that not just comedy, not just all the things you've been talking about, but I will put it this way: that good looks often gets comedians a lot further than they should get. And what really ticks me off is that even though I am phenomenally good-looking, no one has picked up on me. And I haven't got my own TV show. No, I that is really it. Really, for me, it's all the networking, all the rubbish behind it, of actually, you don't necessarily... But this is also tucked in with my laziness, because... I can't be doing with it, so I just would rather go and do it. And I'm one of these terrible people that expect someone to discover me tomorrow, and I know that it doesn't happen like that, but that's what I still act like that's what's going to happen. And even if they do discover me, they might I never know when people are there either. Like at parties, I go to these comedy parties and I'm not looking over people's shoulders, I'm just looking to make sure I don't bump into things. So I miss all the agents. The only people I get are the ones with really loud suits. Like George Melly, I was always talking to George Melly because you can't miss him because of the suit. But actual real agents...
George Melly is deaf.
Yeah, I know, yeah,
he wears suits so we can hear himself.
And he's nearly dead. You probably don't know who George Melly is, are you? He's a jazz musician. He's about 907. And he's Kevin's age group.
And I can tell you one story about George Melly, which is really horrible, and that Mark Lamar did a gig. Have you heard of Mark Lamar? Yeah, Mark Lamar did a gig on in a theatre that I happened to be there at the time. And Mark Lamar went on stage after George Melly and told the entire audience that George Melly was not a very hygienic person in the toilet. So that's all I'm saying. Probably because he can't hear the chain flushing or something.
What was the punchline?
That was it.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. No, it was just a story.
Smelly Melly?
Yeah.
Smelly Melly. Yeah, well,
I was waiting for you to supply that.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
I wish I hadn't.
Yeah, I think the thing that I find hardest in the profession is actually keeping your focus on what you want to do and what you enjoy and not buy into what other people are. And sometimes you can have 20 people going on about what you should do, what you should do, what you should do, and you're sitting there going, I really can't do Bulgarian jokes. I really can't. I can't sing. There's no point getting me to be... They go, oh, you've got to be an all-rounder. That's my other favourite. You've got to be an all-rounder.
Bulgarians are the worst. They're terrible. Where are you in the comedy tree? You know, don't you know, Jimmy Carr's much funnier. He's big in Bulgaria. What are you doing?
I bet you he is as well. I bet you he's
mean
using Bulgarian jokes.
You nothing to the Bulgar sensibility. I've never been on our telly. I'd rather have a glass of red wine than watch you. You know, who are you?
So, next question, which is a bit more serious. Do you think getting...
They weren't serious?
No, they weren't serious. Do you think getting an agent... Oh, I didn't vote, did I? Sorry, you're so good as an audience.
I can hear this I can hear this little babble there saying she's rubbish. She hasn't asked us to vote.
Right, voting on who's the most honest. Do you want Steve Day? Kevin Knight. Oh, look at that. Kevin's won again.
He's so good looking, he has trouble with it. He's holding it
brilliant,
back.
Brilliant, isn't it?
Well done, mate. I thought,
thanks,
I'm going to win
girls.
This one. I thought, that's one I can win.
I'm not only have I done it, but I've pulled as well. Impressive.
Steve, next question. Do you think getting an agent is the solution?
No, it's not. It's nothing to do with it, really. You get, I've got one, and he's currently half asleep on my settee. Watching Sky TV that I got installed. He's getting it somewhere else. He just comes around ours, and we're sponsored by Sky TV in our flat, so we've got all mod cons and everything, and he's coming around a freeloader. I don't know what he's getting his 15% for, eating my pistachio nuts and watching the telly. He's watching Neighbours now, I'm missing it.
So he's done absolutely nothing for your career?
Oh yeah, he's done loads, working his ass off. Oh yeah, so. Yeah, but it was stuff I was doing already, and it just means I don't have to spend time doing it. I can't use the phone, it's really important to keep ringing people up, and that was my worst thing. When I started, I did try, but I'm so useless on it. But I used to turn up on the 17th, like today, nearly. I and you know, think, oh, that's all right. It's the 70th of February, sort of thing.
That's a really crap excuse because I told you to your face at the National Film Theatre, so it wasn't over the phone.
I was running. My phone went when I got home.
What about you, Kevin? Do you think getting a good agent is the solution?
I think it depends. I mean, if you're looking for a house, then good estate agent probably is useful. But in terms of career, I think getting an agent is a kind of fallback excuse for lazy people like me. I would be more successful if I got myself another agent or an agent that would really push me. And I think if you actually work as your own agent and then the right agent comes along, that's right. I don't like the management company thing though, because you get management companies and they're not really agents, they just take over your life and tell you what to do and when to do it and whatever.
Another sugar. You didn't put enough sugar in that. That's management. I get off my agent. Too much milk in that last cup of tea.
Get more pistachio nuts. Yeah.
But yeah, I love pistachio nuts. I'm eating them all now. They're all gone. They'll be gone by the time I get home. I went to Asda. I did a big shop, you know, the big Asda. And I came out of Walmart. It's massive. And I came out and I spent half an hour trying to find my car. So I had, it was a nightmare. I thought, I can't go up to someone and say, I've lost my car. And only then I realised.
And they said, why couldn't you find it? And you said, I'm deaf.
Yeah. I came out of the wrong entrance. But it's a massive place with two entrances that look exactly the same. I spent ages looking around in the wrong place for my car. And the benefit but I brought my pistachio nuts home. But then I came here after the running, and he's probably eaten them now. He's probably taken 15% off the top. I got paid once by a painting. I got paid by an oil painting. You know, Oxy, it's a comedian and artist, he's brilliant. And at that time, he was running a gig which he would have got £40, or he said, I'll do a painting for you. So he did a painting of me and my wife, it's brilliant, put it at home. And he's got an exhibition in Sunderland for a grand to go now.
Fantastic.
Sorry?
And is your agent asking for 15% of
no,
the painting?
No, that's what we're laughing about. What 15% of the painting he could possibly take? It'd probably like trying to cut out the faces or something. He could have a little bit across the bottom. But he was like, how can I? And then when I won that money on Dale Winton, I could tell he was like, trying to work out how he could pay. Well done. How he could looking through the contract about quiz shows. Was that the question? That wasn't the question. Was
it was. It was sort of. Because can agents help in that case? Not particularly.
Pistachio nuts.
Pistachio nuts is the answer. Because I had an agent in my previous career, and I ended up by I used to be a makeup artist, and I was working in lots of fantastic, really weird things like Peter Greenaway movies, and I worked with Archaeus, a circus company, and I worked in operas, and I worked in just really fantastic productions, of which there was very little money going around. And I finally got myself an agent, and she said, you need to have some credibility behind you. You've got this fantastic broad thing of like really weird culty stuff, but we need to actually... do you want some water? Have some of mine. And he put... anyway, she sent me up to Coronation Street, and I had to work on Coronation Street for 6 weeks, and I've never seen a single, you know, single episode of Coronation Street. I had no idea what I was doing or where I was, and I was absolutely miserable, and it was sort of the beginning of the end, really. And I mean, quite rightly, as far as a money-earning thing was concerned, she was absolutely right, but for me, it was absolutely awful, and I couldn't cope with it. And I'm quite wary of agents, because I think if you find the right one that really wants to do what you want to do, which in some cases might mean they're not really going to earn much money off you, excuse me, initially, it can be a fantastic thing. But if you're with an agent who's driving you into an area that makes you more and more unhappy or uncomfortable, even though financially it might be a good thing and you can see the sense of it, it's actually quite a horrible experience. I found it was. I was very trapped. John doesn't do that. I can imagine him trying to make you do Coronation Street.
He created a circuit for me, the deaf lecture circuit that I do. I do daytime talks and all that, and he just made that, created it from nothing. And it's daytime, so it doesn't interfere with stand-up, and it's quite good. I mean, I've got 5 kids and 2 adults to feed, you know, 7 of us. So I need money. So he's done really well there.
And you're very, really happy with it?
Right. Oh, he's not bad. He's good.
Who would you like to know, John? Who's been the most honest? Let's go for Steve Day first. Oh, it's a split vote. Kevin Knight. Split vote. 1 each. Steve Day's... No, Kevin's still in the running there. Still doing the best. So the next question
is...
Yeah,
but it'd be best if we had a low score. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, carry on. No, sorry, I haven't worked out yet.
How much preparation do you do every day? You don't?
For a show.
Yeah, do you write any material?
Actual material. I try and do most of it on stage. But my wife's had all our... We've had 3 kids since I've been doing comedy. We have 3 kids in 18 months. It's really hard work.
With twins.
And I never used to be able... I used to get 3 hours sleep a night. There's no time or space. And I was working 9 to 5. And then coming home and looking after kids and going out to gig. The only time I had was on stage. Just improvised, you know, make-up stuff. So... doing that now. But I thought of a few things here today, so I'll be using them. But that sort of thing, rather than sitting down and going, right, jokes, you know, comedy, I can't do it with a blank piece of paper, it's impossible.
So when you were writing for your Edinburgh show that's on at the moment, how did you prepare for that?
I've done about 25 warm-ups, starting 10 minutes with an idea, and then next time doing 15 minutes, and then just going to the next one. And I came here last week, I had about 50 minutes material, but last night I did an hour and 5 minutes, and John had to stop me because we ran out of time.
You'd happily gone on much longer.
It's the best way to do it, and ideas come in context then, rather than trying to crowbar in a joke you've thought of. The ideas that arise out of the context of what you're saying are always much better, but then you forget what you've done, so I need someone there to follow behind, writing down what I've done.
Making sense of it, because my favourite way of preparing is the same sort of thing. And it's talking about things that have happened to me. My favourite is talking about things that have just happened, like within the day, because I do a lot of emceeing in clubs. But for this show about crime, it was actually, I think I started, because my family experiences and my experience of working in white-collar crime, I could probably talk non-stop for about 2 weeks and still cover, do you know what I mean, a little chunk of it. So when I first did the preview for this, I think I covered about 20% of the stuff I'd written, and I've actually, you know, chopped it and chopped it and chopped it, and I still think there's too much in it. I talk a bit too quickly in the
show.
Can
you sit down and write that and go, oh, comedy?
For me, it's always comedy. Everything about my family background is really, really funny, but it is absolutely catastrophically disastrous. I mean, it's a complete litany of abject failure and hopelessness, and I find it hysterically funny, and I'll sit there. For instance, my father died in February. I haven't seen him for a very, very long time, and he's been married 8 or 9 times, possibly more, we don't know. He lives in South Africa. He's 6'4", and he's got an obsession about being 6'4". And I haven't had contact with him for many, many years, and that's absolutely fine. And I find him hilarious because he's so pompous and he's so, you know, he's just mad. He sees a woman, it doesn't matter what age or whatever, he will go for it and if possible try and marry her. And he died in February, and I was only told half an hour before going to do the gig, and I was just, you know, finding it all very funny, because what had happened, he went in for a heart operation in his town in the middle of nowhere in South Africa. He survived the operation, and then something went wrong. I still don't know what happened, but they said it's time for the last rites. And it happened to have the Bishop of South Africa was there in the middle of nowhere, gave him the last rites. I was thinking, oh, bless him, he must have loved that. And then on one side of the bed was a woman called Clampsy, who was a lecturer in Afrikaans. So probably not Afrikaans, the language of South Africa. And the old language, I mean, they're probably not. So I guess she was unemployed. And he just proposed to her as she was dying. And on the other side of the bed was this woman called Avis, that no one knew anything about either, who he was already married to. So that was my father lying in his bed with the Bishop of South Africa and this woman who had just proposed to. Now, I find the whole scenario terribly funny, and I can see by your faces you're looking a bit shocked. But it's one of those things that, sorry, that you're looking a bit shocked. But having been brought up... Sorry?
Not Desmond Tutu.
That's the Archbishop, and he's retired.
Oh, because you could say, they could have said, the doctor could have come in and said to your father, got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is you're going to die in half an hour. But the good news is Desmond Tutu.
The last rites. I'm sure that's almost exactly what happened. I bet my dad was chopped as hell.
Can I write that down for you?
But this is what I'm trying to get across to you. I mean, my whole family were just telling these terrible jokes about it. It's like, there was like this wife and this and that, and he was probably absolutely having the best last rites it's possible for a man to have. And we were all laughing hysterically because one brother's in Canada, another one's in, you know, the phones were going around it. We were crying with laughter about the situation. And I went on stage and I just thought, I looked at the audience and I thought, I don't think I can translate it yet. I can't make out how hysterical I find it, because I'm sure they'll just look at me just going, oh, that's awful. So for me, a lot of the stories, they are awful, but I find them terribly funny, and it's a question of getting across that actually I'm not that bothered about various situations that happened, which were bloody hideous. I mean, my brother did get anally raped by a neo-fascist in Melbourne prison, which I think is terribly funny if you knew my brother. And, you see, I can see by your faces, there's a look of shock and horror, but... So I don't have a problem writing loads and loads of material. I sit there giggling away at some of these stories of stuff that I've done and other people have done. I'm sitting there. I did a smuggling trip to Egypt, and that was absolutely hysterical. My best friend, my boyfriend, actually got caught on that, but he didn't get any rape. But to me, the problem is actually translating the stuff that I find funny, because I've got a very black sense of humour, across to the audience, so they're not sitting there looking, fucking hell, we've got locked in here with a psycho. So that's, I would say, is where my preparation goes in. It's not lack of material. It's just like making that I genuinely am finding it funny. I'm not making it up that I'm freeing myself of it or using it as therapy. I genuinely find it very, very funny, some of the terrible, ridiculous situations I've got myself into. And I've also been successful, which my brothers haven't, so tough on them. So what's your answer to that question? Do you remember what it is? How much preparation do you do every day?
Yeah, I was just sitting here thinking, actually, how ironic it was that you said you have a black sense of humour. Because, you know, you can't have as black a sense of humour as me, because everything I see is black or blackish. No, the truth is, I'm quite boring. I am one of these people that sits at a computer and tries to write for 4 hours a day and has a target of writing 5 minutes of material a day. And then, but having said that, I spend 4 hours a day at the computer writing material, of which 3 hours and 45 minutes are either playing Free Cell or Solitaire. I have this huge computer screen that I can see, especially adapted for me, and it's blown up so I can see everything I'm doing. It's great. But the trouble with that is, I can blow everything up, but it means when I write, I actually write like two lines fills a page on the screen. So forever, if I write all this stuff, I'm going back, and I have to go back 25 pages to see what I wrote, like a page away for anyone else, which is really, really irritating. But I do write it. I do actually make stuff up as I go along as well, but I would say 90% of what I do, I actually write. I don't gumshoe in jokes, because I do try and write basically a sequentially in my head. This is a very serious fucking answer. I do try and write sequentially in my head, so that I'm actually thinking that I'm talking to people. The other way I actually prepare material is to actually, when I wake up, this is bizarre really, when I wake up in the morning, I find that zone between when you actually are awake and when you're becoming awake, kind of, you're almost in the subconscious zone, is when ideas flick into your head that are bizarre, that you can then work on. And that, I just try and always write them down. In really, you know, I just write them down, and then later on I look at them and I say, what was that all about? And then I try and write about it. So that's a kind of serious answer, but that's the truth.
I'm in that zone until about 3 o'clock.
And you don't write it down?
If I write it down, though, it sounds like I've written it. I am Britain's only deaf comedian. There are any others I haven't heard.
No, I'd much rather prepare material like you. But I find that what I have to do is I have to write it, and then I have to change it into being what I'm saying actually afterwards, rather than at the time. At the time it does sound false. When you've performed it 3 or 4 times, you can make it sound natural.
Yeah. I haven't got the actorly skill. I've got no acting. Acting skills are really good, aren't they, for comedy? But I haven't got any.
I think they're terrible. Do you really? I think they're terrible. I find actors find it really hard to...
Not to be actorly, but to be such a good actor, it looks real. To be able to act yourself, being real, it's quite hard. So yeah. I have to actually be myself, being real. Which, do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
It's taken so many years to learn how to be myself on the stage.
Yeah, I think, exactly. And I think that is an absolute a requirement of a good stand-up, is to act yourself. But you're not actually acting then, you're just not acting.
Sort of. For some people, they can act themselves straight away. Or they find a persona which they inhabit, you know. People who become, like Jimmy Carr, found that persona, he had it right from the start. Hal Crittenden, he's got a persona that he's an actor, but it's like a fits him like a glove, you know, and all his materials supports what he is. And the people who get famous quickest are the people who find a persona that works like that.
Yes.
Sorry, it's nothing to do with the question. There was another question for that.
No, we have to vote now.
Oh, yeah.
Who do you think is the most honest on this one, and how much do you prepare your material? Steve Day? One? Kevin Knight? One each again.
They're very discerning.
This audience is split half and half. Yeah, it's fantastic. Right, last question. And then we can have a Q&A answer from the audience. What is your most proud achievement in comedy?
Have you got an answer straight away?
No, I haven't. My most proud achievement in comedy.
I was the Bachelor's Cup of Soup comedy champion for the Bexley Heaton District area 2003. Reigning Bachelor's Comedy Soup comedy
champion. What, nobody's actually beaten you?
No, they never had it after. They've only ever had it 1 year. I got £50, a £50 note, and had a £50 note for ages.
And lots of soup?
Yeah, some packets of soup, and those big hands, you know, that you see on American football games, that sort of pointing. My kids love the cans. They run around the house and big hands. But they, I gave them a rash. So
This was at Bexley Heath?
Bexley Heath, Yates's Wine Lodge. For the cup of soup thing.
That's your proudest achievement.
No, well, that's like my only honour. I was in something. I came second in something. But I've done a tour, a UK tour, that was very nice. And gigs abroad, Denmark, that was very nice, a gig in Denmark. I did a week going back. America, that's my favourite. New York, I think. Lovely.
So I did a gig in Berlin and I was so proud that
Berlin.
I made them laugh.
Oh,
yeah.
It's closed now, I've got an email show.
I know, they've run out of funding, bless them. But that was a great gig. It was 300 people. I think it was about 18 acts, of which 17 were German, and they had one what they called international act, which was me or Steve. You haven't known, have you?
No.
And you put on generally either at the end or just before the final act, and you were just thrown on to do the stuff, and you didn't know what the MC had said because it was all in German. You didn't know what had happened throughout the night. You were thrown on to do material, and to make 300 people laugh under those conditions was a proud moment.
They don't tell
say.
You as well. You've got to do this encore thing at the end. So if you've really tanked, they hate you. You've got to come back on. And,
which you never do in stand-up. You do it in theatre, but they treat it like theatre. They call you on and you have to stand up there and hold everybody's hands and you have to do this bow.
But I've done all right. But then they asked me if I could recommend anybody. So I recommended Gary Delaney. He's a brilliant comic, but it's all puns, all wordplay. But I thought he'd be good because he speaks so slowly that they'd have time to, you know, catch up. But they just didn't understand puns at all. And he said he was on there for 5 minutes. They didn't even know he was telling jokes. he said it'd be like the worst case of bombing since 1942. He came off stage and texted me and said, I've done so badly. And I hadn't told him about the encore, you know, the curtain call thing. So I texted him, it's going to get worse. And he texted like, you bastard! He'd have to go back on there, sort of like.
It is the most hideous experience. When I did it, I think they changed it for you, but when I did it, they had an all-girl umpah band.
Oh, no, yeah,
sitting
they're on
this
yeah,
bright
on.
Pink
yeah.
settee. It's like almost where Steve Day is. They had this guy. And then the MC, who was some terribly famous television presenter or something.
Arnus.
Yeah, Arnus. Yeah. He's actually really nice, but very German, so he has no expression on his face. And he sits there with his clipboard about where Kevin Knight is. And it's quite a big stage. It goes out the front, but you've got the umpah band there. And then you come through the back door and you come into this curtain and everyone's like, whoa, like this. And you have this, the mic was huge as well. It's like about this big. And you're sitting there like this going, what's going to happen? The umpire band stops playing. The MC sits down with the light sitting and he's sitting on a settee as well. And you just got to launch into your stuff and you don't know who you're talking to. You don't know what's been covered in the evening and you've just got to get there going. It was, it was proud.
I went back.
You have been done
it. Enough to go back. It's all right.
No, but it does feel very, very good to have actually succeeded in those conditions. Because I did something called a sack race. I don't know if you ever saw that, but that was I did a 5-hour improv session as a character in a gift shop, where I had to get fired by 3:00, and my character was someone who's really into alternative nonsense, which I completely don't believe into. But I could actually exercise all my demons about it, and I feng shuied the shop and. I finally got fired for saying I peed in their tea in the morning to help them with their health and make their skins clear, and they actually fired me at 3:00. But it was just the most fantastic buzz to have kept in that character for 5 hours without any rehearsal. You went in there in the morning and you just had to do it and then get yourself fired. And that was a tremendous moment of feeling proud. But I think maybe Berlin beat that. I think Berlin was the feeling that I'd made all those German people laugh.
Yeah.
Was
like, the bloke who got the best laughs on the night was German, but the bald bloke with a plunger on his head. That was his act. I didn't have any plunger material. They loved him. And that's I thought, oh God, if you like him, I've got no chance.
I had a guy who came on, he was wearing a white apron, he was dressed as a butcher, and he had brought out of his apron bits of cow's liver and a chopper, and he just chopped up this cow's liver for 10 minutes. They loved him. They were roaring with laughter. It was a challenge. That's why I think it was quite good. What about you? What's your proudest moment?
I've got three. The first one is the first time I did the Edinburgh Festival, because I actually did it in Glasgow. And my agent at the time put me into this little room in a pub. And I didn't know. And he took me there, and every night I stood up and said, it's brilliant to be in Edinburgh, cultural capital of Europe, and got beaten up, but I kept going. I mean, why I did it after the first night, I don't know. And my second proudest moment is I did a gig at a Slug and Lettuce. You've been in Slug and Lettuce? And basically everyone sits on armchairs and just talks. And they booked us in to do a comedy show in Slug and Lettuce. And there were 200 people in this Slug and Lettuce, big Slug and Lettuce in London. But they hadn't come to watch comedy. So they're all just sitting there talking. And the first two comedians actually bottled it, would not go on, because the noise from out was like that. And it's my proudest moment, because it's actually when I discovered my performing style. Because I thought, stuff it, I'll go on and I'll shout, and I'll try and shout louder than the entire room. And I actually succeeded in shutting them out by the volume of the shouting I was doing, and they listened to me. And I actually turned a room full of people who weren't there to see comedy into an audience, and they laughed at me. But what was really, really cheered me up was all the comedians who were booked going after me, having seen this work, from girls to blokes to camp comedians, all went on and shouted, and they were all getting louder and louder, and it was really funny just watching them try and emulate the loudness I've got. And they could, I am very loud when I shout, and it's kind of like, I was really proud, because I went and did it despite the thing, but B, I've got something out of it, because I actually developed a voice, and I kept it for other gigs, and I can do those gigs that nobody can do, because I can go on and just shout my way through it. And it's like, it's difficult to explain, but that was really great. And the third thing I've forgotten.
So I did one with you somewhere with a God or me with where it was free food or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everybody's there just for, they're not there for comedy. They're there, and they're like, blow me, some bloke speaking in the corner. And the first time I did it, it was free food, anything you want. And a few weeks later when I did it again, it was sandwiches only.
You mean for the acts? Yeah, yeah. For the acts, yeah. They gradually reduced the act payments.
Yeah, every week the budget got less and less. A bit like a packet of crisps by the end, would have been.
That is true, pistachio nuts by the end.
Yeah, oh yeah, I've got my own.
John's eating them all. Right, vote on who was the most honest on that one, Kevin Knight. Oh.
Well, you believe that I went to Glasgow for the Edinburgh Festival.
Right, that's whilst I'm counting out the scores, have you got any questions you'd like to ask? Have you thought of any burning questions? You thought, oh, that's...
I've done enough work already.
I think they'd be great, haven't they?
I know, but if they want to...
Oh, sorry, yeah. Sorry.
What's been the best audience so far in for this show?
What do you think's been the best audience for this festival?
My best audience?
Yeah, I think it's this one.
My solo show is a bit esoteric, so it's not a big crowd puller, but it's a really good show. So I got a big load in on Monday and I had a really great time. And... it's about Caravaggio. I'm getting jokes out of Caravaggio now. It's good though. I mean, it's
like last year I did a show called Postmodernism Comedy and Me, and I had the same thing. I was really proud of it. It was such a difficult show to do. Yeah. And the audience that came were fantastic, but not many came when they saw the title. They were like,
Yeah, mine's building.
Yeah, I like...
Well, it's not about building. I mean, it's the audience building. I really like it.
I mean, the show I'm writing at the moment is highly cultural. It's called Me and My Guide Dog, The Bastard.
Oh, yeah, is that not on? I saw that in Scotsman.
No, it's not on, no.
Oh. No, he's pulled
guide
it.
Dog.
No, audience.
The guide dog pulled out.
He did.
I'm not working with him.
No, he ran away. He ran away. I mean, do you know, this is an aside, but I heard the other day that they're cloning dogs now to eradicate inbred deformities.
Yeah, yeah.
And the biggest inbred deformity in Labradors is blindness. You've got a blind guy with a guide dog,
blind leading
and the guy and the dog go, oh shit.
I think you're the best.
And the guide dog, I'll just let it go. It's only someone booking
if that
up
was
tickets.
You, you'd be in trouble now. It should be picking on you now.
And the guide... No, but I'm just thinking about the guide dog thing. So the guide dog goes blind. And the guy who's blind, how does he know the guide dog's gone blind? It's like... He knows, presumably, when they hit things. But it's a bit late then, isn't it? You know?
But
you have definitely been... You have definitely... What, to smell traffic?
Yeah. Yes.
Might be all right
but
for you.
Only, no, but they won't be able to when it all becomes, you know, lead-free petrol and stuff. Then they'll be
stuck.
We should
let this poor audience go. I think they've worked incredibly
You hard. Have been absolutely fantastic, because this is a very hard thing. It's harder for you to do than for us to do. And you have been absolutely phenomenal.
The best audience both. I'd say.
How
so
many? What? Four? Three stars? Four? What are we giving them?
I'll give them five.
I would definitely say four and three quarters.
Yeah.
We'll hold the quarter back.
Marvellous. They're marvellous.
Yeah. Well, they are marvellous.
Yeah. Mm.
Round of applause for the audience.
Yes. Yay! Absolutely.
Whoa.